Murphy.
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Mullins, and I represent the appellant in this case, Maurice McMurtry. Mr. McMurtry argues that the district court committed procedural error because the district court did not address an issue of arguable merit, specifically whether and how to assess the significance of Mr. McMurtry's substantial assistance. The parties presented different positions on that. The government suggested a percentage reduction from the guideline sentencing range. The government's position was 40% reduction. Mr. McMurtry suggested an approach that has been suggested by this court in United States versus Thomas, and also an approach that has been used by district courts in a number of cases that were cited to the district court below in this case. And that is to assess 2 points for any factor that is fully present. These are the factors under Section 5K1.1 of the sentencing guidelines for evaluating the significance of a defendant's substantial assistance. And it would be 2 points for every factor that is fully present, 1 point for every factor that is partially present, and no points for a factor that are not that is not present. Mr. McMurtry presented his position in a sentencing memo and orally at the sentencing hearing, and the district court did not address Mr. McMurtry's argument. The district court did address the fact of Mr. McMurtry's substantial assistance and went into some detail on whether he was entitled to any reduction at all because of some aggravating factors in the case. But
do we even have jurisdiction to hear this case? Because neither side really addresses the question of whether we have jurisdiction over these appellate claims. And even though you're trying to characterize it as a procedural claim, isn't this really just a challenge to the way the district court exercised discretion under 3553E? And if that is really the heart of the claim, you know, why do we even have jurisdiction to hear it? Because it's a reduction below a statutory minimum.
Well, I think because if the court commits procedural error, even if it's a procedural error with respect to an issue of substantial assistance, I think this court has jurisdiction to consider that. So because we are arguing that it was procedural error, and that would be failing to address a non-frivolous sentencing factor, we believe the court does have jurisdiction, notwithstanding 3553E. And I think that is a different. Booker has modified the court's approach to substantial assistance cases. I believe the rule before Booker was that courts generally did not have jurisdiction to consider the extent of a downward departure under 5K1.1. Booker has modified that, and now the court analyzes for procedural error and substantive reasonableness, and I think that analysis is now different and gives this court jurisdiction. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kelly Watzka, and I represent the United States in this matter. Judge Williams, I apologize. The Court is right to raise that issue in this case, and that was not adequately addressed in the government's brief. I think that it is a fair consideration in this case. But I also understand Mr. Mullen's argument, and to the extent that the Court believes that he can survive or surpass the jurisdictional question, I still think that the sentence in this case stands as procedurally sound. What we're talking about here is really, again, a matter of how the district court chooses to exercise its discretion. We're not talking about an argument in mitigation, as was the case in Cunningham, for example, or the court's decision last week in the Ramirez-Mendoza decision. Those cases involve mitigating arguments about the defendant's conduct, In the case last week, it was about whether or not the defendant had been coerced into participating in a kidnapping. Here, there's really no dispute about the defendant's offense conduct, and there's also really no dispute about what the defendant did to assist the government in his cooperation. And there's also really no dispute that the government, that the defendant was helpful, in the district court's words, that he was very helpful to the government. The district court explicitly made that finding, and in doing so, made specific reference to the arguments that defense counsel made both in writing and at the sentencing hearing. That's all that was required here. From that statement, the court can certainly conclude that the district court considered this sort of mathematically based mechanism that the defendant proposed for assessing the value of the defendant's cooperation, because that's what's at issue here. It's the process, it's the methodology, and the district court was perfectly free to follow the government's recommendation of a percentage-based assessment. I think the defendant agrees that he was not in any way obligated to adopt this mathematical approach. The only issue is whether the district court was obligated to specifically say, for example, I disagree with the defendant. I don't think that this mathematically based assessment is particularly helpful in this case. What the court did instead was it focused on it noted that it agreed with the defense and the government that the 5K1.1A factors, which were set forth in the written submissions, were sufficient to warrant the judge's granting of the motion. And then the court did one additional thing, which was to focus on sort of an intangible thing, which is the defendant's attitude, his mindset, the manner in which he approached his cooperation. And you can see from the sentencing transcript that Judge Randa spent quite a long period of time talking about how the defendant had brought sort of a new sense of maturity to his cooperation that was reflected in his mother's comments, how the defendant was doing the cooperation not just to benefit himself but because he viewed it as the right thing to do. Those are intangible type issues that a district court judge is in the best position to assess. That's what the judge chose to rely on in this case. And this district court made a sufficient record from which this court can conclude that the defendant's arguments were considered, the defendant certainly received a reasonable sentence, it was well below the advisory guideline range and the statutory mandatory minimum. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll simply ask the court to affirm the defendant's sentence.
Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Thomas case indicated that district courts have discretion to utilize a percentage decrease or the decrease that Mr. McMurtry recommended, using the 2 points for every factor that is fully present. It's a discretionary call by the district court. Each side had a position on that. The district court did not exercise its discretion because it did not address the defendant's position on that. And the Cunningham case states that before this court can conclude that the judge did not abuse his discretion, it must be certain that he exercised his discretion, that is, that he considered the factors relevant to that exercise. We cannot have much confidence in the judge's considered attention to the factors in this case when he passed over in silence the principal argument made by the defendant. And that's what happened here. This was the principal argument made by Mr. McMurtry, that his assistance was worth more than what the government suggested it was worth. And we're not saying that the district court could not consider Mr. McMurtry's attitude in providing his substantial assistance, but that does not excuse the district court from failing to consider the factors that Mr. McMurtry raised and the detail that Mr. McMurtry went into as far as how his assistance should be evaluated. And that's why the case rises to procedural error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now, counsel, did you take this case by appointment?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much again, and appreciate your representation.